In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences, with more added all the time. View on any device whenever and wherever you want. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. For 20 years, the homepage of emergency medicine. Subscribe now.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the September issue of EmedHome's EMCast. My name is Amal Mattu from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and once again, welcome back. Hey, before we get into the session this month, I just once again wanted to remind everybody out there about our upcoming 10th annual The Crashing Patient Conference. It's going to be held on our campus, but it's going to be available to all of you virtually. Check out the website, www.thecrashingpatient.com. It's going to be October 14th. There's going to be some pre-conference and post-conference stuff. Everything's going to be virtual, though. So anyway, check it out. All right, on to the podcast for this month. We've got, once again, three topics. We're going to start things off by talking about a high-risk chief complaint. Specifically, we're going to talk about abdominal pain and some frequent misses in the abdomen. One of our junior faculty who has a special interest in risk management, Dr. Rupal Jain, is going to be reviewing a really great article published not too long ago in Emergency Medicine Clinics of North America, an issue that was entirely dedicated to risk management. Then we're going to move forward and talk about another high-risk topic. Mike Wieners is going to join us and talk about an area of his interest outside of the critical care realm. Specifically, we're going to be talking about back pain and cauda equina syndrome. And then we're going to finish things up. Dr. Danya Kosha is going to rejoin us from Japan once again, and she's going to spend some time going through actually several articles from the emergency cardiology literature talking about infective endocarditis. What are the updates in terms of diagnosis, treatment, and also antibiotic prophylaxis? So with that, let's go ahead and we'll get started. All right. Well, kicking things off on EMCast this month, I have a returning guest, Dr. Rupal Jain. Rupal's been on the EMCast maybe once or twice. Rupal, how many times have you been on the EMCast before?
Yeah, I think you're right. About twice.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, welcome back. And just a little bit of background about Rupal since it's been a while. She works at Prince George's Hospital, which is here in Maryland. It's one of our affiliate hospitals closer to D.C., very high volume, really high acuity. She is a prior resident. She stayed on to do a chief year in faculty development fellowship. She did ACEPS teaching fellowship, and she has gradually become more and more involved in academic medicine and getting involved in the speaking circuit as well. One of the areas that Rupal has an interest in is risk management, and she gave a very nice talk last time on discharge instructions, and it just so happens that in our curriculum, July and August are largely focused on teaching the residents about risk management, and Rupal actually precepted one of these sessions, and this was a talk and discussion that she did with the residents focused on abdominal pain, and there were so many great clinically relevant things that they went over that I thought it would be worth discussing that on EMCast. So we're going to go through a couple of topics based on articles that were published in a recent issue of Emergency Medicine Clinics of North America that was entirely focused on risk management in emergency medicine. And we're going to get things started by going through a chapter that was written talking about high-risk complaints, specifically high-risk issues in the abdomen. The authors of this article were Sharon Board and Christopher Curry. This was one of the articles that Rupal discussed with the residents. The other article that she discussed with the residents, we will do in an upcoming month. Anyway, they went through four abdominal conditions that are definitely important to consider, but are actually often missed. The first condition that the authors address is appendicitis. And we know this is definitely an often misdiagnosis. So, Rupal, once again, welcome back. And perhaps you can take us through some of the reasons why appendicitis is so frequently misdiagnosed.
Thank you so much for having me back on EMcast. It's so good to be invited back to discuss risk management topics with you and your listeners. So for appendicitis, pretty much be worried about this with anyone who presents to the ED with abdominal pain or flank pain. Maybe the only exception is if they've had a prior appendectomy. And even then, beware that your patients can still have stump appendicitis. All of this is to say, beware of appendicitis. And as you mentioned, you're right, appendicitis is often misdiagnosed due to the atypical presentations, which leads to appendiceal rupture, an unwanted morbidity and mortality, and therefore lawsuits.
And all right, so let me interrupt you for just a second. So the classic presentation that I learned, and maybe that you learned also, is that periumbilical, dull aching pain, which over the course of 24 hours migrates to the right lower quadrant, and there's nausea and vomiting, a low-grade fever, and of course, the elevated white blood cell count. Is that pretty much the way you learned it?
Exactly. And I blame the overemphasis of this exact classical presentation of appendicitis in medical school and in training for why emergency physicians miss appendicitis so often.
All right. Well, so what aspects of those things are false or don't actually work out?
Well, see, atypical presentations occur due to variations in the anatomy of the appendix. So, for example, with retrocecal appendix, patients can present with right flank pain and even right testicular pain. Patients with subsecal appendixes can present with suprapubic pain and urinary frequency. And appendicitis can even present with right upper quadrant pain, especially in our patients who are pregnant as the growing fetus displaces the appendix upwards. Appendicitis can also present with left lower quadrant pain and even generalized tenderness when there is appendiceal rupture and associated peritonitis. So we can't rely on the periumbilical pain and we can't rely on right lower quadrant pain as the sole presentation of appendicitis. The diagnosis is also tricky in children who may not be able to describe or localize their pain. In these patients, we have to consider appendicitis when the pediatric patients have difficulty walking or jumping, or if they have pain with percussion, or even just generalized symptoms of malaise, poor PO intake, and vomiting. In the other extreme of age, the elderly, we also have to have a high degree of suspicion in these patients who may not have the classic localizing right lower quadrant pain and instead may present with vague symptoms of nausea, vomiting, and poor PO intake.
All right, so just to recap for a second, you mentioned three patient groups that we have to be careful about: the extremes of age, so children, especially infants, and then the elderly. And also you gave us a very nice reminder that during pregnancy, the appendix can get pushed upwards and you can end up with right upper quadrant pain. So those are three patient groups to just be really careful about. So keep going.
Exactly. And so basically, once we have this high degree of suspicion for the diagnosis, we then have to order the correct imaging. Because unfortunately, labs, when viewed in isolation, are neither sensitive nor specific for the diagnosis of appendicitis. So for example, a normal white blood cell count and a normal CRP may decrease your suspicion for appendicitis, however, cannot fully exclude or rule out the diagnosis. The same is true for procalcitonin, amyloid, and calprotectin.
I don't think I've ever even ordered those last couple of labs. I don't know if they'd be a send out.
Yeah. I've never ordered those either. But you know, the test that many of us are ordering is a urinalysis, especially for patients that present with lower abdominal pain. But know that up to 40% of patients with appendicitis can have urinalysis abnormalities, including pyuria, hematuria, and bacteria. So don't be the emergency physician that misdiagnoses appendicitis with urinary tract infection because you see white blood cells in the urine. Because remember that patients with appendicitis can have a sterile pyuria rate of up to 87.5%.
Wow.
And that's, super high. And that's because, remember, the inflamed appendix can lie in close proximity to the ureter or the bladder.
And I guess if it lies close to the ureter, I've heard that you can drop some red cells into the bladder. And sometimes those patients get misdiagnosed as even renal colic as well. So that urine is, it sounds like the urine can really lead to a lot of misdiagnoses when it's abnormal.
Right. And I don't know who needs to hear this, but unfortunately, remember that your patient can have as many well diagnoses as they please. So they can have a urinary tract infection and appendicitis, or a kidney stone and appendicitis.
That's right. I think that was Hickam's dictum, right? Occam's razor says they're only allowed to have one diagnosis, but Hickam's dictum says your patient can have as many bleep diagnoses as they darn well please. You're right.
And as far as imaging goes, CT is the most commonly used diagnostic modality in adolescents and adults. But remember that the CT can miss early appendicitis and may not even visualize the appendix in some cases. Ultrasound is the initial test of choice in kids and is increasingly utilized in the pregnant population. However, know that a negative ultrasound does not exclude the diagnosis. Therefore, the emergency physician must maintain a high degree of suspicion in these cases of non-diagnostic ultrasounds in pregnant patients and children, and an MRI might be helpful in this case.
So, Rupal, I remember back when you discussed this in conference recently, the topic came up about how CAT scan and ultrasound can actually be a little bit complementary based on the patient's body habitus. So, for example, CAT scans are not... Even though we use CAT scan for everything, CAT scan actually has lowered sensitivity in certain body types. Ultrasound is better in certain body types. Can you just go into that just a bit?
Sure. So in thinner patients, CT scans have a lower sensitivity for appendicitis due to the lack of mesenteric fat. And essentially, all the intestines look sort of mushed together on the CAT scan, making it difficult to identify the appendix. In plumper patients, however, owing to their larger body habitus, the appendix can be difficult to visualize, and therefore a CT scan would be more sensitive for appendicitis.
So if you have a really skinny patient, the CT is more likely to give you a false negative, but no problem because ultrasound is great for those skinny patients. And then for the plumper patients, it's kind of reversed. So it is kind of complementary in many ways. Now, the other question that oftentimes comes up is, what's the deal with contrast? Do you normally give contrast for these patients?
So the American College of Radiology does not recommend the use of oral contrast as a standard to identify appendicitis. I think that the one situation in which oral contrast may be helpful is in that young, thin patient, in which case oral contrast may help kind of light up the intestines and identify the appendix.
Got it. Okay, great. So those are some great pearls and pitfalls to be on the lookout for with regards to appendicitis. Next in the article, they talk about the ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, or AAA. Now, this is not a real common diagnosis. It's not something that we see every day, but it's probably one that we at least think about or are supposed to think about every day. Yet, this is actually one of those diseases that is not an uncommon source of malpractice. It shows up in litigation. So why is that? Why do we have a tendency to miss ruptured AAAs?
Well, you're exactly right. Simply put, AAA is a high-risk diagnosis due to the high mortality associated with AAA rupture. This condition, therefore, requires timely diagnosis and treatment. But it's also a common source of misdiagnosis. And this is because symptomatic non-ruptured AAA patients may present with vague symptoms such as indolent abdominal pain, or low back discomfort, flank discomfort. And even those who have a ruptured AAA, according to one retrospective study, 25% didn't present with any pain at all. Only 45, exactly, and only 45% of them had abdominal pain and 17% had flank pain. And you remember, again, that classic presentation, the triad of abdominal pain, hypotension, pulsatile abdominal mass is right. Only present in, again, a quarter to a half of presentations. So we can't rely on these classic presentations to exclude these high-risk abdominal catastrophes.
Let me ask you, when do you think about working a patient up for the AAA? Do you consider this in every patient coming in with abdominal pain or with back pain, or how do you sort through the fact that the classic presentation, which we've all learned this classic triad, is just not that common? Is there some set of patients that you really worry a lot more about that we should be on the lookout for?
Yes, the suspicion for this diagnosis should really be increased in the right patient population. So think male sex with untreated hyperlipidemia, smoker, hypertension, family history of AAA, history of a large vessel aneurysm in the past, and those with increasing age. That's considered to be age greater than 65. The other risk factors that I hadn't thought about before reading this article includes use of fluoroquinolones in the past 60 days. Hmm. Also, remember certain physical exam findings, such as ecchymosis of the flank or the Gray Turner sign, or periumbilical ecchymosis, the colon sign, ecchymosis of the scrotum, the Bryant sign, or proximal thigh, the Fox sign, should also raise suspicion for rupture.
Got it.
Let me also mention, interestingly, factors that are associated with decreased risk of AAA include black race, Hispanic ethnicity, and a history of diabetes, which I was very surprised to read.
That is interesting. I mean, usually they talk about cardiovascular risk factors as increasing your risk for AAA. So I would have expected diabetes to be an increased risk factor as opposed to a lower or something that lowers your risk. I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. Another key point that the article makes is that more and more AAAs that are non-ruptured and are asymptomatic are being picked up incidentally in the emergency department as part of our workup. So make sure when this happens that the patient is made aware of this finding and that it is included in the list of patients' diagnoses, as also mentioned as part of the discharge instructions, to be sure that the patient follows up regarding this finding.
Okay, so let's say that you do make the diagnosis of the symptomatic AAA, whether it's ruptured or unruptured, and you need to do something. This is not a patient who's going to follow up as an outpatient. What should we be doing with that patient?
So if you diagnose a ruptured AAA, timely treatment is critical here. So that includes emergent consultation with vascular surgery, blood transfusion, and ordering uncross-matched blood if needed. But the one thing that is really important to remember that is that just like in trauma, permissive hypotension with systolic blood pressures of about 80 to 100 are recommended in order to prevent further aortic wall tearing. And also remember that pain control can also help with these spikes in blood pressure.
All right. Fantastic. Okay. Ruptured AAA is definitely one of the true killers that are hiding in the abdomen. But one of the other abdominal conditions, which also is a real killer that we all learn about, but we probably don't think about enough, and that is mesenteric ischemia. And as a result, at least not thinking about it, certainly is one of the reasons that it oftentimes get missed. What are some of the other reasons that we tend to miss mesenteric ischemia?
So mesenteric ischemia is especially challenging to diagnose because it's so rare. Only 1% of acute abdominal pain presentations coming into the ED are related to mesenteric ischemia. But we should really have a high suspicion for this disease in the elderly, as this percentage increases from 1 to 10% in patients older than 70 years of age. Another reason why mesenteric ischemia presentation can be kind of mixed up is because mesenteric ischemia has four subtypes. And with each of these subtypes, there's a different classic pain presentation associated with it and different associated risk factors, further complicating the diagnosis of this for the emergency physician. So I want to kind of take us through all four of these subtypes. The first is acute arterial embolism. So think of the patient with atrial fibrillation that throws a clot to the mesenteric arteries, causing acute occlusion. Now, these patients might present with abdominal cramping for a few hours, and then it's followed by a pain-free interval during which the transmural bowel ischemia progresses, and then it's followed by diffuse severe abdominal pain due to peritonitis.
So that's the classic presentation that we all learned about, the arterial embolism, the superior mesenteric artery embolus, I guess, and its abrupt onset and the cramps. I didn't realize that there is this pain-free interval, actually. I hadn't heard that before. But is this the classic presentation of that pain out of proportion to physical findings that they show up with?
Exactly. So that is the classic presentation. It's the pain out of proportion. And this, again, remember, is the physical examination finding where the patient has minimal tenderness in the period before there's transmural bowel ischemia, necrosis, and peritonitis. So the patient is reporting significant pain, but when you go to examine them, they're actually not quite tender at all.
And then eventually, once they go from mesenteric ischemia to mesenteric infarction, that's when they develop the peritonitis that you've been talking about.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's the first type of mesenteric ischemia. You mentioned that there's four types. What are the others?
So next is arterial thrombosis or atherosclerosis. This is essentially where the plaque builds up and the plaque rupture is causing arterial occlusion. So this is like the acute MI of the gut. And this pain can present more subacutely because of the production of collaterals. Therefore, there is often a delay in the acute presentation by days to weeks.
And this is, as I recall, this is the intestinal angina type of presentation where people, every time they eat, they get abdominal pain. And so they develop this aversion to food. And I've heard about patients losing a lot of weight over the course of months before they finally develop the full-blown infarction.
Exactly. And then the next is non-occlusive mesenteric ischemia, or NOMI, which occurs in low-flow states, such as in hemodialysis or ECMO. And then lastly, mesenteric venous thrombosis, or DVT of the gut, which can present abruptly, similar to acute occlusive arterial disease.
And we know that because these patients often present with some nausea, maybe some vomiting, and also early on they develop diarrhea, very frequent misdiagnosis for these patients is simply gastroenteritis. Okay, so Rupal, you went over the four types of mesenteric ischemia. Once you have a suspicion for this, what's next?
So if you have a high suspicion, we have to order the special fancy CT angiography rather than the CT abdomen pelvis with IV contrast that's timed for the portal venous phase. Unfortunately, looking for things like occult blood may increase your suspicion for the diagnosis, but can't exclude the diagnosis of mesenteric ischemia. Lactate may also increase your suspicion for the diagnosis. However, a normal lactate can't be used to exclude the disease. Ultimately, even if your CTA is negative, your lactate is negative, you don't have occult blood, you still have to have a high suspicion for this disease entity and make the appropriate consultation with surgery or IR. Medical treatment in the meantime may include initiation of heparin, management of shock with fluids, and if needed, by the way, the vasopressor of choice in the situation would be dobutamine or milrinone or low-dose dopamine. Also, remember to include initiating antibiotics as part of your management of this very high-risk disease with high mortality.
All right, fantastic. And as I recall, mortality, once they go from ischemia to infarction, the mortality jumps from about like 15% up to 80 or 85%. So the body doesn't like having dead gut in the abdomen. All right. Well, the final condition they addressed was one that I wasn't really expecting, and that was small bowel obstruction. I didn't think this was a commonly missed diagnosis or mismanaged condition, but I learned a few things reading about this topic in the article that I hadn't learned before. So can you take us through this topic and why it's in there?
Yeah. So small bowel obstruction also carries a high risk of bowel necrosis, perforation, and peritonitis. Whereas your pretest probability for this diagnosis may increase in patients with prior abdominal surgeries and therefore suspected adhesions, know that 3-9% of patients with small bowel obstructions caused by adhesions have no previous history of abdominal surgeries.
Wow. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. So your suspicion for this disease should really increase if your patient tells you that they have a history of prior partial obstructions or complete obstructions, if they have a history of abdominal hernia, malignancy, and again, prior abdominal surgeries. In terms of their presentation, they may say that they have been constipated or that they have relief of their pain with vomiting. And on exam, abdominal distension is found to be the most predictive finding for small bowel obstruction. But here's the kicker. Small bowel obstruction can actually exist without abdominal pain at all or any abdominal tenderness on exam, which is what makes it so highly misdiagnosed in the emergency department.
Well, let me ask you this. If the patient doesn't have any abdominal pain, what is it that's going to tip you off that you need to worry about it? Is that more the distension and the vomiting that tips you off?
Yeah, so I would consider this diagnosis in those that report that maybe they've been constipated but don't really have the associated pain, those with poor PO intake, with vomiting, that relieves their symptoms. And then also, again, just with the patients with the risk factors. So those with prior abdominal surgeries, those with abdominal hernia by history, those with prior partial or complete obstructions.
Okay. Now, once you've got your diagnosis, what's your next step?
Again, CAT scan is really your test of choice here. And the American College of Radiology does not necessarily recommend that we have to get CT scans with oral contrast. In fact, don't order a CT scan with oral contrast, as this will only lead to delay in diagnosis. The other common misstep is over-reliance on abdominal x-rays, which are only 75% sensitive for bowel obstructions.
That's a lot lower than I would have thought.
Yeah, exactly. Another risk management pearl here is that once a bowel obstruction has been diagnosed, remember to consult general surgery. Even though we know that many of these bowel obstructions are not managed surgically, it is important to get general surgery on board in order to guide management, which may include observation, but could include surgical treatment as well.
All right. Well, this has been a really great discussion of these four conditions. Any final thoughts or wrap-up comments you have, final pearls you want to leave the listeners with?
For all of these acute abdominal conditions, a high index of suspicion is required for all comers to the ED with abdominal pain, especially in the elderly, children, and pregnant populations. There is often no risk factor, element in the history, or physical exam finding that completely nails the diagnosis. And similarly, there is no laboratory finding or imaging study that completely excludes the diagnosis. The risk management strategy the article recommends, and I'll leave you with, is as follows. For those who have low pretest probability and who are considered safe for discharge, be sure to have a shared decision-making conversation with the patient in which the patient expresses comfort with close home observation and agrees to return for any worsening. The emergency physician should clearly outline return precautions both verbally as well as in written form in the discharge instructions. Prior to discharge, documentation should include serial abdominal examinations and demonstrate improvement. Now, for those who have persistent pain despite negative workup in the ED, the physician should not hesitate to retain these patients in the emergency department for further serial abdominal examinations or just admit them. It's a good idea at this point to consult the specialist early if going down this route in order to determine if further diagnostics should be escalated or if other therapy is recommended.
Fantastic. Well, Rupal, thanks so much for helping us out. You know, I've always believed that the abdomen is the real black box of the human body. A lot of people say that the brain is, but for me, the abdomen is. And I'd say that probably the biggest misses, major misses in my career have always been intra-abdominal conditions. And it's largely because so much of what we learn with the abdomen is classic, and classic never shows up in real life, unfortunately. Thanks for taking us through some of those pearls and pitfalls, and I look forward to getting you back on a future EMcast real soon. All right, well, next up on EMcast, we're going to spend a bit of time talking about an article published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine earlier this year, 2020, called Evaluation and Management of Cauda Equina Syndrome in the Emergency Department. Now, cauda equina is not a real common thing, but it is one of those things that we are all taught to look for and think about. It's certainly one of those needles in the haystack of back pain. We see so many patients with back pain that it's very easy to get cavalier about what dangerous things might be lurking below all those musculoskeletal back pains. So anyway, this is a nice article, and our discussion today hopefully will rein people in a little bit, rein myself in as well. So joining me is one of my colleagues that you've heard many times, a regular on EMcast, Dr. Mike Winters. Mike, welcome back. This is not your typical critical care type of ventilated patient that we often talk about, but it's very important nevertheless.
Well, thanks for having me, Amal. It's always a pleasure to be on EMcast. And this is, as you said, one of those back pain emergencies. And before I really delved into resuscitation and critical care, it was an academic opportunity that you provided me with respect to pearls and pitfalls and back pain emergencies that led to some publications, but it also led to opportunities to review a number of medical legal cases pertaining to missed back pain emergencies. And one of them actually is Cauda equina syndrome. So something I continue to see and review in terms of risk management type of literature, along with one of these just critical conditions associated with patients who come in to see us with back pain. So it'll be a fun discussion.
Yeah, I remember that chapter now. That was quite a few years ago, and we both had a bit more hair back then. So,
well, yeah, unfortunately, mine is now gone, but you still have a lot more hair than me left. But nonetheless, I still remember that article and a few that you've been able to provide me with since. So, my thanks.
All right, Mike, first of all, can you take us through a little bit of the anatomy and the pathophys and a bit about the etiologies? What causes Cauda equina?
Absolutely. So recall that the spinal cord ends with the conus medullaris, and that's usually around the L1, L2 vertebral level. And then you have the nerve roots traveling from there, and that is the cauda equina. In essence, it is the lumbosacral and coccygeal nerve roots from the L2 to the coccygeal segments. And essentially what that segment controls is motor function of the lower extremities, sensation of the lower extremities, bladder control, as well as control of the external and internal anal sphincters, sensation of the external genitalia and perianal regions, along with sensation of the coccygeal region. And in essence, cauda equina can result from any process that compresses those nerve roots anywhere from the L2 to the coccygeal segments. And that could be due to direct compression, inflammatory processes, venous congestion, or ischemia. When we talk about etiologies, by far and away, the most common etiology of cauda equina syndrome is, in fact, a large central disc herniation or prolapse. And that can be either at that more common L4, L5, or L5 S1 level. That accounts for about 50% of the cases of cauda equina syndrome. A few other inflammatory, infectious, venous congestion etiologies of cauda equina syndrome include ankylosing spondylitis, trauma, IVC thrombosis, malignancy, so any neoplasm, multiple sclerosis, so involvement of that segment due to MS, infectious etiologies such as a discitis or subsequent epidural abscess, and then in patients receiving cancer chemotherapy or radiation to that region of the body. But by far and away, the most common etiology to remember is a large central disc herniation or prolapse.
Great, great. What are the typical symptoms that we ought to be thinking about or looking for or asking about that would tip you off to, you know, heading more in a direction of working this up?
Absolutely. Well, I think what will get these patients to our emergency department setting is back pain. Now, there usually is a delay in the time that patients develop their symptoms to the time when they present, and that can be anywhere from 10 to 11 days. So it's usually many days into their pain process. And the classic red flag symptoms that we learn about, read about, and remember with respect to thinking about cauda equina syndrome are the abrupt or severe onset of low back pain, accompanied by bilateral sciatica associated with saddle anesthesia or some sensory changes in the genitalia or perirectal or perianal region, accompanied by bowel or bladder dysfunction and sexual dysfunction. Once again, those nerve root compression resulting in what those nerve roots actually control. So acute onset back pain, bilateral sciatica, saddle anesthesia, bowel or bladder dysfunction, and sexual dysfunction are the big red flag symptoms. Now, to that end, a few nice pearls that the authors of this article go through that I think are important to note from making the diagnosis of this neurothreatening condition are that patients can present acutely or abruptly, that many of these people will have some degree of chronic back pain, i.e. that chronic disc pain, degenerative joint condition, or degenerative disc disease, but they come in and there's an abrupt or acute worsening of back pain. That's when you want to start to think, could this be a cauda equina syndrome or another back pain emergency? Now, they don't always have to have complete urinary dysfunction or bowel dysfunction. Sometimes that can just be reduced urinary sensation, a decreased desire to void, or simply a reduced force of urinary stream associated with discomfort. A few other pearls are that actually it's unilateral sciatica that tends to be more common than the bilateral sciatica that we see in textbook cases or confirmed cases. And pain is often exacerbated in the supine position. If this is typically due to disc disease or musculoskeletal back pain, recall that that usually improves when patients are at rest or lying in a supine position. But if you're getting or eliciting the history that pain is aggravated or worsened by the supine position, that's when you want to start heightening your pretest probability that this could in fact be cauda equina syndrome. And lastly, what I would say is urinary retention. Simply urinary retention in and of itself, in the absence of back pain, can in some cases be the only feature of cauda equina syndrome. Now that makes it incredibly difficult to diagnose. The majority of times patients will get to us because they've had an abrupt increase or new onset severe acute back pain. But keep in the back of your mind that just urinary retention alone could be the initial and only manifestation or presenting symptom for cauda equina syndrome.
Awesome. Awesome pearls. And what about the physical exam findings that we should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some great pearls and potential pitfalls when we do the exam. What we're looking for and we should focus our exam on is decreased perineal or urinary sensation, assessing for perianal or perirectal sensation. Is there any decrease in rectal tone? So because the cauda equina nerve roots control the internal and external anal sphincter, is there decreased anal tone? Also looking for motor or sensory abnormalities in the lower extremities. And then another key physical exam finding is the absence of a patellar and Achilles tendon reflexes. Now, importantly, just like with the historical features, the classic textbook that we learn of, there are some pitfalls with respect to the physical exam findings. Okay, so what are those potential pitfalls or pearls with the physical exam? Well, importantly, no single physical exam finding is sufficient to exclude cauda equina syndrome in isolation. The most specific exam findings that should clue you in to cauda equina are bowel incontinence, perianal or perineal anesthesia, and reduced anal tone. Most of these findings in general that we just reviewed have a lower sensitivity, but if we're talking about specificity for cauda equina syndrome, it's bowel incontinence, reduced anal tone, and then sensory changes or anesthesia in the perineal area.
All right, awesome. So if we see a patient and have some concerns about this diagnosis based on history and physical, what confirmatory testing should we use, if any?
Well, this tends to be fairly quick in the sense that really don't waste your time with labs. We know that no lab study would really be diagnostic of cauda equina syndrome. Labs, if any, that you would want to obtain or send are pre-op labs. And that's the sense that if you make and confirm this diagnosis, patients need to get off emergently to the operating room. But in terms of confirmation, really, it's not done with labs. It is going to be with imaging. Now, before we get to the gold standard imaging, it may be, and it's probably very reasonable, to perform a bedside ultrasound exam, your point of care ultrasound exam, to really assess bladder volume. One of the hallmark diagnostic tests that we do to screen for the possibility of cauda equina syndrome is a post-void residual. You're looking for that acute urinary retention that results in symptoms of overflow incontinence. Now, in terms of the actual number, Amal, I think you and I have probably seen various numbers throughout different textbooks, different articles, ranging anywhere from 100 to 150 to maybe 200 mLs as a post-void residual. The authors here of this article state that any PVR post-void residual in excess of 500 cc's has a high odds ratio of being cauda equina syndrome or acute urinary retention. That may be a little high. I'm used to talking about and reviewing resources that put it more around the 200 to 250 mLs. Not sure if your experience has been any different.
Yeah, I learned a normal post-void residual should be under 50, so I have an even lower number. I start worrying when it gets to about 100 to 150, and in elderly patients, especially elderly men, I might allow that to go up to about 200 or so. But 500 does seem quite a bit to use as a cutoff. I agree with you there.
So just getting back to our point-of-care ultrasound, if you have a suspicion, patients report urinary or genitourinary abnormalities, they have an abrupt increase in back pain, have them attempt a void and use your point-of-care ultrasound to measure the post-void residual rather than performing a straight Foley catheter insertion or bladder catheter insertion. Now, in terms of imaging, no need to spend time obtaining plain films. They are not helpful in making the diagnosis of cauda equina syndrome. Really, the gold standard is an MRI. MRI, the sensitivities and specificities, while not 100%, really are considered, that this is considered the diagnostic test of choice to confirm cauda equina syndrome, to image that lower lumbar segment and the sacral segments to determine if there is nerve root compression or signal intensity change. Now, for those that have a contraindication for whatever reason to MRI, it is recommended to go ahead and do CT myelogram. However, that would not be your test of choice if you had the ability to obtain an emergent MRI. It's gold standard. That gold standard test is MRI.
Great. Yeah, CT myelogram is definitely a bit more invasive, but if you can't get the MRI, then that might be what you need to do. Now, once you make the diagnosis, what are we doing to manage these patients and how quickly?
So this is definitely one of those emergent causes of back pain, spinal cord compression that we are absolutely on the clock for. So this needs to be an immediate consultation with your spinal surgeons. Now, in most cases, that's going to be neurosurgery. In some locations, it may be orthopedic spine, but these patients need to get to the operating room for an emergent decompression of the cauda equina compression. So this should be, consultative services should be emergently obtained. And often, if you have a high enough suspicion, even before you obtain the imaging, it's worth involving your consultants to give them a heads up that this is a patient that you're strongly concerned for cauda equina syndrome, you're obtaining the right imaging, and that you'll be calling them back should it be positive. But this is definitely something that needs to be emergent consultation.
All right. Well, fantastic. Thanks, Mike. That's a great review of the article. Now, I know that you've been consulted in some med mal cases on this topic over the past handful of years. Would you say that there's any common pitfalls that you tend to encounter over and over in these type of cases that you can share with us?
Yeah, I have some important pearls and potential pitfalls. If we just back out and take a look and talk about back pain emergencies in general, whether that could be missed epidural abscess, missed cauda equina syndrome, missed epidural metastasis with resultant spinal cord compression, it really kind of falls into a few big buckets from a risk management standpoint. The first and I think most obvious would be a failure to make the diagnosis. But more often than not, it's performing an inadequate exam, failure to communicate appropriately with either ordering the diagnostic study of choice or our consultant physicians, perhaps even ordering the wrong test to begin with, and then delays in surgery for those that ultimately do have a spinal cord compression. So in terms of cauda equina syndrome, failing to ask about perineal sensation abnormalities, failing to ask about genital or genitorectal abnormalities. Sometimes it can be a sensitive area, but every patient that presents with either acute back pain or acute on chronic back pain, you want to be asking about genitourinary as well as rectal or bowel problems with respect to their, or in association with their back pain. In terms of the exam, testing that area. So if there's any hint of genitourinary or rectal abnormalities, really truly assessing anal tone, assessing sensation of that perineal region, really doing a good motor exam of the lower extremities with attention to the reflexes in the patellar and Achilles location, and then really not wasting time getting blood work or getting plain films, moving right to MRI. That's going to help also in confirming other back pain emergencies such as epidural abscess or cord compression due to metastatic disease. And truly, in the cases that I've had a very high suspicion, as I just mentioned, I involve the consultant surgeon at the time that I'm ordering the diagnostic imaging modality, namely MRI.
Great. Well, I think that was a fantastic wrap-up and some really great take-home points that you've left us with. So, Mike, once again, thank you so much for contributing your time and your expertise in this topic, and look forward to getting you back here for some more great discussions.
As always, Amal, thanks for the opportunity to talk to you on EMCast, and I will look forward to our next discussion.
All right, folks. Well, now let's turn our attention to infective endocarditis. I've actually had several articles sitting in the to-be-discussed pile of articles for pretty much about a year, maybe 2 years for a couple of these articles in particular. And our good friend Dr. Danya Koja, who is one of our affiliate faculty members, spending time in Japan this year and next year, has graciously volunteered to run through these articles. And this is a really great and very important topic. So, Danya, welcome back. Okay, well, let's get into these articles. And these are a little bit different from what you've done in the past. As the listeners probably by now know, Danya's major interests are emergency geriatrics and emergency neurology. And this topic, we're going to talk about endocarditis. This is a topic that has been kind of on my list of things to discuss for EMCast for quite some time. These articles actually go back about a year now, and they're still very up to date. But Danya jumped on board with these articles. And so why are you and I talking about infective endocarditis? I know why I am, but why are you talking about infective endocarditis? Where's your interest in this topic?
Well, as you know, Amal, I love old people, and infective endocarditis should be considered a geriatric illness to you.
Okay. All right. Everything should be considered a geriatric illness to you.
I am claiming infective endocarditis because actually 30% of patients with infective endocarditis are 65 or above. The demographics are shifting. We usually think of infective endocarditis as IV drug use plus fever. Oh, that's infective endocarditis. But the reality is that the demographics are shifting. And infective endocarditis is actually not just increasing in the older population, but it's increasing overall for a whole bunch of reasons. We have chronically ill people who are living longer. We have an increase in healthcare associated infections, which is a big chunk of the older people. And also, I think we're doing a better job at detecting infective endocarditis. So that's why we're seeing it more often. So that's a good thing, I guess.
I guess so, from the standpoint of your interest. Well, I'm glad you jumped on board with this because it is an important topic for us to address in many different ways. And I forgot to mention the articles that we're going to talk about, so I'll just mention that now. One of them is a review article from JAMA from actually July 3rd, 2018, Management Considerations in Infective Endocarditis, a review. And then the other two both deal with the topic of antibiotic prophylaxis, and they were published in Circulation in July of 2019. So again, thanks for doing these articles. So you talked a little bit about how this is something that's showing up more and more in elderly patients and in chronically ill patients. It's, I'm sure, associated with patients that have valve replacements, which is very common in the elderly. What else can you tell us about some of the demographics?
So as you pointed out, Amal, it's the fact that we're having more prosthetic valves, cardiac implanted devices. Those are a couple of the reasons that people end up having infective endocarditis. But another thing to keep in mind is that a third of the cases in high-income countries are the healthcare-associated ones. So in people that don't just necessarily have abnormal valves, but also have dialysis catheters in place, non-hemodialysis catheters, they've had invasive procedures that have made them bacteremic, and so on. And then the other chunk is the IV drug use in the U.S., which has actually increased over the past decade. And that is the number one cause of community-acquired infective endocarditis still. The other reason that we want to talk about it and we should keep talking about it is that it's a very lethal disease. The mortality is 20%. So one out of every five people that gets admitted to the hospital with infective endocarditis is going to die. And the scary part is that this has not changed in the past two decades, despite the fact that we have a lot of advances in trying to figure it out and diagnose it. And it's possible that the reason is because the organisms are becoming more and more resistant. And the patients are getting older with more comorbidities, so that's why their outcomes are getting worse.
Sure. So 20% mortality is definitely a lot higher than I think most of us probably think of. Most infectious diseases we tend to get on top of and don't have that terrible mortality, but 20% is definitely concerning. So what are the presenting signs or symptoms that we need to worry about?
So infective endocarditis can either be acute or subacute. Acute is your ill-appearing febrile illness. These are the people that you can't really tell how they're different from someone who's coming in with like generic sepsis, except that they would have a new heart murmur. I don't know about you, Amal, but I can find it really hard to figure out that someone has a new heart murmur in the middle of the ED when they are sick and everybody's yelling in the room. So that's why it's definitely important for us to just think of it as a possibility. The other one that can be more easily missed, I think, because it's a lot more subtle, is the subacute. So those are the ones that are coming in with just like fatigue, weight loss, not feeling well for weeks or months. The classic features that we've learned about in medical school, like Offler's nose, Janeway lesions, Roth spots. I'm not sure who's looking for Roth spots in the emergency department because that's not me. But those are only present in 5% of people. I think that the other way that we end up seeing it, and to be honest, I think that's one of our like lucky finds, is when we have someone coming in with the embolic phenomena. So as we know with infective endocarditis, they send emboli to various parts of their body. So they can either present with a stroke, and that's 20% of patients, or they can have a non-stroke embolization to a different body part. And that's 1/3 of patients. Things like renal infarcts, pulmonary infarcts, splenic infarcts. And in my personal experience, outside of patients coming in with the acute illness in the setting of IV drug use, I've seen it as embolic phenomena over and over again.
Yeah, the emboli really are one of the big problems that we need to worry about. If somebody has right heart vegetations, they'll embolize to the lung. And we see a lot of that in Baltimore because of the injection drug use. We see a fair amount of septic emboli to the lung, and patients will come in with what looks like multi-lobar pneumonia with a murmur, and that's a tip-off. And if it's a left-sided valve that's got the little vegetable on it, it'll embolize to various other areas of the body, including the brain. So I knew somehow you were going to bring neurology back into this.
I didn't. Infective endocarditis did. I didn't.
Okay. All right. Well, when should we suspect this? Obviously, if somebody's coming in with the fever and stroke symptoms, and that kind of makes it easy. And I usually pick up the Roth spots and the Janeway lesions. But aside from those no-brainers, when should we be suspecting this diagnosis?
I think that the key for us to continue to pick this up and do a better job at what we're doing is to cast a wide net and think of it in any ill-appearing person or non-specific presentation who is coming in with underlying risk factors. So underlying risk factors is in older adults, people who have abnormal valves, whether we're talking about prosthetic valves or that they have a valve or a heart disease, such as we don't tend to see this often in the US, but rheumatic heart disease. The ones that we tend to see a lot more often are like mitral valve prolapse or degenerative valvular disease. People who have VSDs and bicuspid aortic valves as well. So congenital heart disease that has not been repaired. And then obviously patients who have a history of something similar. So people who have a history of infective endocarditis or IV drug use, that puts them at a higher risk as well. And then when people have catheters in place, so hemodialysis catheter, intravascular catheter for any reason, or ICDs or pacemakers in place, so indwelling cardiovascular devices, because the reality is that they have this external body that actually is connected to their heart with wires. So that's definitely someone to keep in mind as a risky patient.
Right. So these are not just your typical cardiac risk factors that we list for pretty much every disease in the book, but some of these really are special risk factors, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely, because we tend to not think of having an ICD or a pacemaker as a risk factor from that standpoint. As I said, these electrodes are connecting these things to your heart. And then if the electrodes themselves get infected, then technically that's infective endocarditis, even if you don't have an infection on the valves themselves or on the endothelium. So that is why this is pretty tricky. Sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes patients come in with a device pocket infection. So the area around their ICD or pacemaker is, you know, red, swollen, and infected. Or sometimes the device erodes through their body and through their skin, and you can actually start to see the wires. Those are obvious, but sometimes it's just hematogenous spread, and this bacteria comes on, latches onto the leads, and you don't really have much
of a tell other than the fact that they have that ICD or pacemaker in place.
So is there anything different about how we diagnose these patients?
So not really. The basics of infective endocarditis are the same. Staph aureus is still the number one cause overall, so 30 to 40% of patients. We need to get echoes in everyone, and we need to get blood cultures in everyone, and then use the modified Duke criteria to try to figure out who has infective endocarditis. As I'm sure everybody remembers, with the modified Duke criteria, you either have someone who has a definite infective endocarditis, possible infective endocarditis, or rejected. You have major criteria, minor criteria that have to do with blood cultures, endocardial involvement, vascular and immune phenomena, fevers, risk factors, and then depending on that particular combo, then you say, okay, well, they have a definite or a possible infective endocarditis. A couple of things to keep in mind as well is that Staph aureus is not the only bacteria that can cause infective endocarditis. You also have Strep viridans and enterococci. And then the other thing are gram-negative, Hasek, and fungi. None of this stuff is new. These are just reminders. And the biggest thing that the article reminds us of when it comes to this bread and butter infective endocarditis is that in order for us to increase the yield of blood cultures, we should get 20 mLs of blood per bottle, which is a lot of blood if you think about it, because most bottles have that like finish line or whatever it is. And that's usually at around 10 mLs. And to be honest, Amal, we don't even get to fill it up to the 10 mLs. Sometimes you know exactly what I'm talking about. Sometimes we put in 2 mLs and call it a day and go like, here you go, we got a blood culture. Well, surprise, it's going to be negative.
Right. Just enough to change the color of the fluid on the inside. Right. No, that's true. The more blood you get, the more likely you're going to have a positive yield. Now, you mentioned echo as being an important part of the diagnosis. What are you looking for on the echo, or how do you use that?
So with echoes, we look for things, as you mentioned, vegetations, and then we look for complications like abscess, fistula, leaflet perforation, valvular regurge, prosthetic valve dehiscence, if that's what's there. Now, the sensitivity is different. So with a transthoracic echo, it's around 70% sensitive for native valves. It's not too bad, but it's not that good, to be honest. But for prosthetic valves, it's 50%. So it's a lot cheaper to just get a coin and flip it and then just go with that because you have a 50% chance they're going to catch it. That said, if you correctly choose patients and you decide to use echo to exclude infective endocarditis, then it's a really good test. So if you have a patient who comes from a very low risk population, so that means that they don't have any cardiac abnormalities that predispose to endocarditis, and they don't have any intracardiac catheters, no prosthetic valves, they don't have any abnormal valve anatomy or function, they don't have cardiac congenital abnormalities, no pericardial effusion, and no vegetation. In those low-risk patients, you have a 97% negative predictive value for that transthoracic echo. So if you pick the low-risk patient and you have a negative echo, you're pretty much done with that diagnosis. But overall, it's 50 to 70%, so not that great. The other thing that we can do is transesophageal echo, which is 95% sensitive, so much better, but obviously a lot more invasive. So we can't really just sit there and do transesophageal echoes on everybody. But definitely if you are thinking about a prosthetic valve infection, that is something that you're probably going to end up needing to do. And then the other one is that if you suspect a lead infection, so those are the people who have the ICDs and the pacemakers, and you're worried about it being infected, but their endocardium and their valves look fine, that transesophageal echo is going to be able to look at that lead and try to figure out if there are vegetations on it. The other thing is that if you're worried about an abscess and you can't really tell, you can also see that so much better with a transesophageal echo.
Got it. All right. So we're going to be looking for some clinical signs and symptoms. We're going to get, we're going to bleed them for blood cultures. All right. Where the echo, transthoracic echo is okay. Transesophageal echo is pretty darn good. Are there any other imaging tests or any other diagnostic things that we should put on our list?
So this, for me, was a huge update from, you know, medical school things that are, you know, the blood cultures and the echo and the things like that, is that we now have access to cardiac CTs, if the echo is unclear or if you have a suspected abscess or an aneurysm, you can always just do a CT and look at that and see if you can delineate that, like a cardiac CT. Another thing that you can use, which I thought was really cool, not sure if we're going to be using it in the emergency department though, is nuclear imaging, where they label white blood cells and then they inject it back and that finds emboli in the body. And then the great thing is that you can actually use these two elements as part of your Duke's criteria, which is what we always end up going back to diagnose that infective endocarditis. The other couple of things as well, which are definitely not what we are going to do in the emergency department, but thought it was interesting, is that when your blood cultures are negative, there are some serological studies, histopath, PCRs, things like that, that can be done to find out this bacteria that's causing these infections, even if their cultures are negative. The reason I am bringing this up is two things. One, echoes and blood cultures are not 100%. So if you think someone has infective endocarditis, there are things to be done. And the second thing is bounce backs who left the hospital and are coming back with a very typical infective endocarditis picture, but their typical traditional workup of blood cultures and echo are negative. There are things that we can do for them. There's more that can be done. So it may be worth bringing them back in so that they can get that workup done as inpatient.
A lot of our patients that are being worked up for endocarditis, for some reason, end up leaving AMA. I can't figure out the association there. Unfortunately, since we have a high population of injection drug users, as you know from having worked here for so many years, when they don't get their drugs in the hospital, they sign out, they oftentimes will go out and start shooting up drugs again and then come back. And now you really do need to work them up all over again because now they're coming back after a new dirty needle injection. And it's a vicious cycle that happens.
It's absolutely a vicious cycle. And it's also pretty challenging when we're trying to figure out whether these patients need surgery or not, because that also gets us into a bigger issue. So yes, it's definitely a huge challenge. And I think that there's a lot that can be done to try to optimize that. Unfortunately, it's just very, very difficult, as you said.
Yeah, it's tough to you do your best for the patients, and it can be very frustrating sometimes, but you got to keep going. So in terms of the treatment, since we just kind of touched on that, what is the current recommendation regarding treatment? What do we do once we bring them into the hospital?
So since Staph aureus is what we're thinking of as the most common cause, we know Staph aureus is most commonly resistant to methicillin, so it's MRSA. So the standard treatment for that is VANC. You can give daptomycin, and what's pretty interesting is that apparently nobody can agree on the correct dose of daptomycin, so always just double-check the dose with your pharmacist, because the FDA says we should just give 6 mg/kg, which is an underdose, because the IDSA, the Infectious Disease Society of America, says 8 to 10, and the European guidelines say 10 or more. So I think we should just sit together and make their minds up so that I am not confused. Otherwise, just call your pharmacist, and they can help you deal with that.
I'm trying to figure out an easy way to remember this dosing regimen, since everybody has a different dosing regimen. All right, so daptomycin.
Call your pharmacist. Just memorize your pharmacist number. And that way, it's easy. It's the same number for all your medication questions.
All right, good advice.
Now, if you have a patient with a prosthetic valve, those are the ones that you want to add an aminoglycoside, so something like gentamicin, and a rifampin to it. Now, if it's a native valve that's getting infected, then there's no need for you to add these two medications. Now, if the patient magically has MSSA, so methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus, then you can use nafcillin, which is actually better than VANC at eradicating this infection. Now, if it's a person who you think that the cause of it is not Staph aureus, so it's not coming from a skin infection or a hematogenous spread of Staph aureus from somewhere else, then enterococci are less common, but they are a pretty common cause of infective endocarditis. And for these patients, it's actually ampicillin and an aminoglycoside. And keep in mind, those are the ones that are going to have more of a treatment failure.
Okay, got it. Now, you mentioned surgery earlier. Who needs surgery?
So if someone's coming in for an acute heart failure, like acute severe valvular dysfunction, usually severe regurg, for example, like a prosthetic valve dehiscence and something like that, causing them to have heart failure. Those are the ones that are going to need an emergent consultation for possible valve replacement or valve repair. Now, there are other people that should be considered for surgery, people who are coming in with like abscesses or continue to have emboli, multi-drug resistant organisms, persistent bacteremia, typically not the things that we think of in the ED, but our big thing in the ED is acute heart failure from an acute valvular dysfunction. That's why when you have someone who has a left-sided endocarditis, a prosthetic valve, a device in place, or complicated endocarditis, just give a call to your cardiac surgeon and see if they're able to come in and take a look at the patient. If it's acute heart failure, call them and tell them to run to the emergency department to see your patient.
All right, fair enough. Let's change gears a bit and talk about prevention. So it's not typically something that we talk about, but antibiotic prophylaxis for endocarditis has always been something that we've had to think about, and it shows up on the board exam and is an area that seems to constantly be changing over the past 15 or 20 years or so. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So classically, we talk about dental procedures and how they're a major source of bacteremia, they're requiring prophylaxis. But the reality is that that's probably not true. There's a lot of things that cause bacteremia that we do every single day, like chewing and brushing our teeth. So I'm not sure if we're supposed to prophylax for all of that. So to clarify, we're talking about a slightly different population. We're not talking about infective endocarditis from Staph aureus. We're talking about infective endocarditis from strep infection. And that is the one that comes from the dental procedures and that whole prophylaxis story. So theoretically, we should give antibiotics for this whole dental procedure, but the data is not consistent. First of all, there are no randomized controlled trials, and the guidelines can't even make up their mind. They're unclear. They're coming in from expert consensus rather than strong evidence. So the American Heart Association and the European Society for Cardiology say, yes, there are some people who we need to prophylax after dental procedures. The United Kingdom National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, NICE, say that we should not be doing that. So in the past few years, so actually in 2007, the American Heart Association scaled down on antibiotic coverage and said, okay, well, you know what? It really looks like the evidence is not that good. We're probably causing more problems with the antibiotics than we are preventing. So maybe it's only the super high risk group, the highest risk groups that are the ones that we should be giving them these, we should be giving them this prophylaxis. And the study that I read in Circulation by Garg is a very interesting population-based cross-sectional study where they looked at the data before and after this change in recommendation. And they noticed that there is a significant decrease in antibiotic prescriptions for the moderate risk group, understandably. But what has happened is that over these years that they've done the study for, they have noticed that there is an increase in the rate of infective endocarditis in both moderate group and high-risk group. So it doesn't sound like the reason is the change in the antibiotic recommendation, but it seems like we talked about before, it's the fact that infective endocarditis is just increasing in the population and the fact that the high-risk people are increasing in the population. However, the proportion of those coming from strep is the one that has decreased, which means that the recommendations make sense. We should only stick to giving it to the high-risk people. So the two questions that all of these guidelines and studies are trying to answer is, one, what are the procedures that we have to prophylax after? And two, who are the people who we need to prophylax? And an interesting thought, it's not who is more likely to get infective endocarditis, but who is more likely to have a poor outcome if they were to get infective endocarditis.
Got it. Okay, so that's really interesting, the disparities between the U.S. and Europeans versus the Brits, who have a much higher threshold to treat, or they don't treat at all, really. And yet the incidence of endocarditis seems to be equivalently increasing everywhere just because of higher incidence. So who knows whether this prophylaxis works. But really, how does that relate to us in the emergency department? What exactly are we supposed to do? Danielle, I want some answers. Tell me what to do. I don't care about all the guidelines. I don't care about the Europeans or what the British are doing or what the AHA is saying.
Well, the British and the Europeans are fighting, in case you didn't hear that part.
Everybody's always fighting. So I just want to know, what do I do with my next shift when I've got somebody who comes in and for whatever reason, I'm worried about the possibility of endocarditis. Just to take it back a little bit, back when I was in residency in the early 90s, we were prophylaxing everybody. You know, we would, if somebody had any high risk features We would prophylax them before Foley catheters. We would prophylax them before they had an IND, or rather before they had an abscess IND'd. There were some recommendations that if they were going to get an anoscopy, they would get prophylaxed. And I mean, there was just so many different things we were prophylaxing. And then every 5 or 6 or 7 years, new guidelines would come out and they would decrease it more and more and more. And now I don't know who, if anybody, to prophylax. So, Danya, I'm relying on you to give me the definitive answer for 2020.
Well, I'm going to give you the answer for 2007, because that's where when the AHA guidelines got updated. But you should be able to apply that in 2020 with a small little caveat. So what the AHA guidelines say is that depending on the procedure, so dental procedures, hopefully you're not doing them in your ED that often, procedures on the respiratory tract, on infected skin, on skin structures, and on musculoskeletal structures, which includes, interestingly enough, body piercings. So I'm not sure if you're doing body piercings in the ED, Amal, but body piercings would need prophylaxis as well, not tattoos. So GI things like anoscopy and endoscopy and things like that, no. GU procedures like Foley's, no. Those are the ones that we don't do anything for. What I'm taking from this is that my INDs, that's a big yes. And then of course, if that's also in the mouth, because I think that's the only dental procedure we really do in the emergency department. Now, who are the patients that we are going to be giving this to? So as I said, it's going to be just the highest risk of patients. So those are the ones with prosthetic valves. And keep in mind, prosthetic valve also means the people who had a transcatheter aortic valve replacement. If it's someone who had a previous infective endocarditis, if it's someone who had an unrepaired cyanotic heart disease, if someone who had a repaired heart disease but they used prosthetic material, and someone who had a cardiac transplant and has a valve abnormality in that heart. Those are the people that we should prophylax according to the AHA. However, I am sorry I'm not going to give you a straight answer here, because that study that we talked about from GARG that looked at the data before and after the change in the recommendation says that, you know what, although we did take the bicuspid aortic valve and the mitral valve prolapse off of this list, their subgroup analysis of that group of patients saw an increase when we stopped prophylaxing them. So that is not within the guidelines, but they say, you know what, maybe that was not a good move stepping away from these two populations for these high-risk procedures.
And in terms of the prophylaxis, what do you typically give them?
So if they can take PO and they don't have any allergies, then an amoxicillin would be a great option. If you want to give them IV, then ampicillin for that. If they have allergies, then depending on what the allergy is, you can either give them a ceftriaxone or Clinda. Those are pretty much your top options.
Got it. Just one dose an hour or two before the procedure, I suppose.
Yes.
So anything else that we need to know?
Yes, Amal, we should all brush our teeth after eating. And I'm going to quote the 2007 guidelines directly. Maintenance of optimal oral health and hygiene may reduce the incidence of bacteremia from daily activities and is more important than prophylactic antibiotics for a dental procedure to reduce the risk of infective endocarditis. So if we give people toothbrushes instead of antibiotics, we are going to change what's going to happen.
So before we do the IND of that pilonidal abscess, we need to have them go brush and floss their teeth.
Well, preferably we should ask them to do that at all times, but yes.
All right, good. All right. So what are your take home messages for the group? I've got mine. I'm going to go brush my teeth right after this, but what are the take home messages for all of us?
So the big take-home messages are that we should keep a high index of suspicion for infective endocarditis and shift our thought process from thinking it's a disease of IV drug use with a fever to older adults, prosthetic valves, pacemakers, and ICDs. We need to think of it in healthcare-associated individuals and healthcare-associated settings, so people with catheters and hemodialysis catheters. We need to remember that echo is not 100%, especially if we're thinking of a prosthetic valve or a lead infection. Remember that for these patients, you can do a transesophageal echo or a cardiac CTA, and that will change your management because you're going to find abscesses and things that show infective endocarditis that you didn't think of. Remember that if you see anybody with an embolic phenomenon, then these are the ones that need blood cultures, antibiotics, and echo. And then after that starts scaling down because the mortality is high and we need to be aggressive. From a prevention standpoint, keep in mind that people who have prosthetic valves, history of infective endocarditis, or congenital heart disease that's not repaired, then those are the ones that you need to prophylax for some of our ED procedures. My big ones for me are INDs. Our high-risk patients, we should prophylax. I don't think we do a good of a job as that as we should.
All right, Danya, thanks. Got some nice take-home messages from this. And you did actually clarify some questions. And I also thought that, just like you did, the use of the cardiac CT to look for vegetations is kind of a nice option for those of us that don't have the either the skills or the equipment or the fancy machines to do the detailed echoes, especially TEs. It's kind of a nice option to be able to scan them like that.
Absolutely. Have somebody else read your images. You don't have to do it yourself.
Fantastic. And brush your teeth. Brush and floss. I remember my dentist once saying, you don't have to brush all your teeth, just the ones you want to keep.
I like your dentist.
With that, we will conclude. And Danya, once again, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on EMCast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Take care. Talk to you later. All right. Well, it's time for our end of the podcast summary of the three topics. Let's go back to the beginning. We started things off by talking about high-risk chief complaints in the abdomen. And the highest-risk chief complaints that we discussed were the appendicitis, the ruptured AAA, and mesenteric ischemia. So let's start with some key pearls about appendicitis. Even though our imaging technology is so good with appendicitis, we still have a tendency to miss the diagnosis because the patients don't present typically or classically the way we've all learned. We all learn periumbilical pain that migrates down to the right lower quadrant over the course of 24, 36 hours associated with nausea and vomiting, anorexia, fever, elevated white count. All of those are classic, which means they're always in the textbooks and on the board exams, hopefully, but in real life, oftentimes they are not there. In fact, even right lower quadrant pain is oftentimes not present. If a patient has a retrocecal appendicitis, it may be right low back pain. The patient may have appendicitis sitting near the bladder, which causes bladder inflammation, and drop some white cells into the urine, or if it's sitting near the ureter, it can drop some red cells into the urine, and as a result, these patients can easily be misdiagnosed as UTI or even a renal colic, and sometimes there may be that asymptomatic bacteriuria that we see so often in the elderly, so it's very common for these patients to be misdiagnosed as having UTI. And then when they simply don't feel well and have the nausea and vomiting, especially at the extremes of age, the young patients and elderly, which are most often misdiagnosed, they can be misdiagnosed as having just a viral syndrome or the flu or something like that. In terms of imaging, CAT scan's fantastic, but remember that CAT scan, of course, there's radiation issues there, so we don't like using the CAT scan in really young kids. CAT scan also has the drawback that if your patient's really skinny, there may not be enough periappendiceal fat in your patient for the CAT scan to end up being positive. So you can get false negative CAT scans. Fortunately, ultrasound tends to work in particular well in skinny patients. So ultrasound and CAT scan can oftentimes be complementary in your really skinny patients. And that certainly would include the kids. Go for the ultrasound, but in patients that have a little bit more weight to them, that's where CAT scan ends up being the best. And also, remember that with regards to CAT scan, all of the literature, especially the radiology literature, is really, well, I shouldn't say all, but the majority of radiology literature has really pointed towards the fact that we don't need oral contrast to still get diagnostic CAT scans with evaluations for appendicitis. Now, obviously, that may vary depending on your radiologist's level of comfort, but maybe it's time to start pushing those radiologists a little bit and dropping an article about the fact that they don't need oral contrast. Just accidentally drop an article on the floor in front of them. Accidentally slip one of these articles under their office door. Accidentally put one of these articles in their lab coat and then walk away. And maybe we can gradually push them towards skipping the contrast. The second major high-risk topic we talked about was the ruptured AAA. This is one of the real killers in the abdomen, especially in middle-aged and older patients. Again, classic triad of abdominal or back pain plus the pulsatile abdominal mass plus the hypotension is very, very often not present. You can't rely on it. Make sure to know what the risk factors are. There's a lot of atherosclerosis type of risk factors. One additional risk factor that I never knew about before was recent fluoroquinolone use. That puts patients at higher risk. So yet another strike against the quinolones. And have a low threshold for getting an ultrasound. We really didn't talk much about imaging with these patients, but this is one of the really great hallmark indications for bedside ultrasound in the emergency department. If you have a middle-aged or older patient and you have even the slightest bit of concern for a ruptured AAA, get that ultrasound and take a look. It won't always tell you if they're ruptured, but it'll tell you if there's a AAA. And that, simply knowing if there's a AAA often, in combination with their signs or symptoms, is enough to get that patient up to the operating room really quickly. Make sure to consult early and type and cross for a lot of blood if these patients have ruptured. And then we talked about mesenteric ischemia. Most common misdiagnosis is gastroenteritis because a lot of these patients will show up with gastroenteritis symptoms. They'll have crampy abdominal pain. They'll have some nausea. They'll have some diarrhea. A mesenteric ischemic bowel, an ischemic bowel will try to empty. And so early on, they may have some frequent loose bowel movements. There may be some blood in their bowel movements as well. And then there can be kind of what I refer to as a lucid interval. It kind of the bowel becomes lucid. The bowel becomes painless for a little while. And that's when they're going from ischemia to transition over to infarction. And once they develop the full-blown infarction, that's when patients get super, super sick. And by then, as they say, the horse is out of the barn. Mortality approaches 80, 85% by the time they infarct. So our goal is to diagnose before they infarct. Our goal is to diagnose them when they're still just in the ischemic phase. And typically those patients will have that pain out of proportion to physical exam. Now, the best test for these patients is a CT angiogram, not just a plain old CT, but a CT angiogram. Even better would be a traditional mesenteric artery angiogram if you can get it. And if you're looking for labs, remember the white count can be very, very elevated, but it can be very nonspecific. Lactates are pretty good. Studies have shown that if your lactate is normal, then it's a pretty good negative predictor, but it's not nearly perfect. Of course, it takes a while for that lactate to rise. So if you catch them really early, then of course, the lactate can sometimes still be normal. But lactate is probably the best lab test that we have. And if you have any suspicion, get that CT angiogram. Next, we talked about Cauda equina syndrome, which is, again, one of the can't-miss causes of back pain. What are the signs and symptoms to be on the lookout for? Well, abrupt onset of low back pain that's associated with bilateral sciatica or bilateral saddle anesthesia or sensory changes in the perineal area, bowel or bladder dysfunction, especially overflow urinary incontinence. They'll have big distended bladders. Their post-void residual will have several hundred cc's of urine. They may have some sexual dysfunction. They may have nothing more than urinary retention, even in the absence of back pain. So if they have urinary retention, and especially if they have some saddle or perineal decreased sensation or decreased rectal tone, you've got to work them up for this. Or if they have a decreased desire to void, the test of choice with these patients is MRI. Don't waste your time with x-rays or CAT scan. The diagnostic test of choice for these patients is the MRI. So don't putz around by getting inefficient tests like x-rays or CAT scans with these patients. And then we finish things up by talking about several articles dealing with infective endocarditis. I think probably the most important part of this diagnosis is knowing the risk factors for endocarditis. So what are the risk factors or who are the patients at risk? Well, injection drug use is obviously very important. Prior history of infective endocarditis may be the biggest risk factor of all. Once you have a damaged valve from a previous endocarditis episode, you will forevermore be at risk for developing endocarditis when you get bacteremic. Or if you have a new prosthetic valve, you're going to be at higher risk as well. Other risk factors include advanced age, multiple coexisting medical conditions, immunosuppressive conditions, prosthetic valves. If somebody goes for frequent invasive procedures, for example, dialysis, that's going to put them at increased risk for frequent bacteremia. And also if they have implanted cardiac devices like AICDs or pacemakers, or if they have structural heart disease. So keep all of those patient populations in mind and lower your concerns about endocarditis if anyone comes in sick. The most common bug is going to be staph, followed by strep. Staph, as of 2020, is probably the most common culprit. In terms of diagnosis, of course, echo is your best diagnostic test. But in the emergency department, we're not necessarily doing echoes to look for endocarditis. What we can do in the emergency department that really helps the people upstairs and helps these patients is to get multiple sets of blood cultures, a minimum of 3 good quality, good sets of blood cultures. That's going to really increase the yield in terms of finding an organism and being able to narrow down the antibiotics. If you can't get an echo, or if you do get an echo and it's unremarkable, there is interesting literature that I had not really heard about before, which talks about using a cardiac CT, which can further delineate valvular pathology. So that is something that we could potentially get in the emergency department. In terms of management, you want to use antibiotics that are targeted against gram-positive organisms. I think in this day and age, we're pretty much always starting with vancomycin, and typically we're adding an aminoglycoside or a third generation or fourth generation cephalosporin to get those gram negatives as well. And don't forget, if a patient has a prosthetic valve, you also have to add rifampin. Don't forget the rifampin if somebody has a prosthetic valve. Now, finally, what are the current recommendations for antibiotic prophylaxis? There's some variation amongst the different procedures, but the ones that Danya listed were, if somebody has any of these invasive procedures, significant dental procedures, respiratory procedures, or skin or soft tissue invasive procedures. If they have any of those procedures and they are a high-risk population, they need antibiotic prophylaxis. What are the high-risk populations? Patients with prosthetic valves, patients that have had transcatheter aortic valve replacement, the TAVR, patients with a prior history of endocarditis, patients with unrepaired cyanotic heart disease, and cardiac transplant patients with valvular heart disease. So again, if you undergo any of those 3 invasive procedures and you are also in that high-risk group, those are the patients that need the antibiotic prophylaxis. And how do you prophylax these patients? Well, you just give them a single dose of amoxicillin or a cephalosporin or clindamycin, maybe about an hour or two before the procedure. Just a single dose ought to do it. We'll put all of this information in the show notes, so you don't necessarily have to remember it, but don't forget about the antibiotic prophylaxis and asking about antibiotic prophylaxis indications in patients that you see before you cut into their teeth or their gums or pull out a nasty infected tooth or something along those lines, all right? All right, well, that about does it for the September issue of eMedHome's EMCast. Hope all of you out there are staying safe and doing well. Hope your families are well. Keep wearing the mask. Keep washing those hands. And we are going to be done with this pandemic, hopefully, really, really soon. Until then, take care.
Hey, thanks for listening to EMCast. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to eMedHome.com.